This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
A lot of movies to discuss. It being a Friday afternoon, Dr. Kermode brings in the coffees, as he always does, as he always pays for
them. Thank you, but you were, exactly, and you were giving me a really foul look because David was bringing them in, but I want to say that I had started the
Nobody
coffee...
Nobody knows who David is. You make a reference to someone called David.
Everyone who listens to this show knows who David is, because every week I say David did this or David did that.
It's just unprofessional.
It's not unprofessional, it's true. And I'm sorry if the truth is unprofessional, Simon, but there we go.
In this case, it is. Ian Softley, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
I'm sorry about the insanity into which you've clearly walked.
He's used to this.
But you would think you had other things to do, really, on the day that your movie Inkheart opens. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much. Well, it's all in the lap of the movie gods now. We've been doing all the work. We were in Berlin for the world premiere on Tuesday night and 3 days of press, and we were doing press the week before that. And so now is the time to sort of sit back and chew all my nails off.
Yes, and just wait and see what the people's verdict
exactly
is, never mind what the critics think. I don't know. Yeah. Some of them really like it. The only critic that matters, of course, you're sitting next to, delivered kind of half a judgment last week, which is because Paul Bettany was on.
Well, yes,
you were very enthusiastic.
No, I am, and I still am very enthusiastic. The thing was, what I was trying to do was maintain the illusion of tension so that we can review it this week. But, I might as well... Would you want Ian to describe the film first, or shall I tell you what
I think regulars who've been with us for a long time will be familiar with the story, because Cornelia Funk came on the programme and we reviewed it as a book, and we're very interested in the story, but... Take us back to the beginning.
It's the story of a man played by Brendan Fraser who has the ability to read characters out of books. And this is as much...
To read characters out of books.
So that when he reads a book, they come to life. They jump off the page.
They jump off the page.
Off the page and into our world.
No, I'm sorry. I was just being specific, because otherwise if you just read characters out of books, it sounds like just reading out.
Yeah. He's the director. Say what he wants.
It's a deliberate play on words.
I know that. I'm a critic. I'm clever.
There you go. And it's... the reason it's a curse is because 9 years before our story starts, when he was discovering reading aloud for the first time characters out of the book, he lost his wife into the book. So there's a kind of a Faustian exchange here, and we join the story where he's been searching for another copy of this book, Inkheart, so that he can read his wife back out of the book again.
But what? Right. So the book that this is based on is called Inkheart.
It's called Inkheart.
And the book within the book is called Inkheart.
It's called Inkheart. Okay. Mirrors within mirrors. What happens is that there have been other characters, kind of like medieval gangsters, who came out of the book the first time when he read those out of the book and his wife went into the book. And one of them, played by Paul Bettany, Dustfinger, has been tracking for 9 years the Brendan Fraser character, so that when he does find a copy of the book, he can force him to read him back into the book, where he can be reunited with his wife. So it's a sort of... There's this disparate group of characters who all kind of work together trying to pursue their goal, which is the reunification of their families.
And the idea of having Brendan Fraser there was clear right from the word go. It appears as though Cornelia Funk actually thought this... Before the movie deal was sorted, it was Brendan Fraser who she wanted to have as the main character.
That's right. Well, I think the first book is dedicated to Brendan, because saying that he inspired the character of Mo. I mean, Brendan was very sweet, because when I was asked to direct the movie, I was told this story and everything, and that Cornelia was very keen on having him on. But he flew to London. He flew himself to London and took me out to dinner and said, "Look, the last thing I want is to be in a movie where the director doesn't want me cast." So he says, "You have to consider that it's a clean slate, and you now have the opportunity. I hope you're going to cast me." And I mean, I'd already said that I thought he was, he was pretty perfect for the role. He's a sort of Pied Piper with kids, Brendan. I don't know whether you've ever seen him with kids, but he has this ability to charm and mesmerise children.
Well, we loved him in Our House right from George of the Jungle, where it was quite clear from that. I mean, a very funny kids movie.
Yeah, very funny.
But a very funny movie for parents as well.
Since Ian has just done that setup, it feeds very nicely into the first clip that we have. Shall we have the first clip that we have?
Shall we have a vote on it? Who wants to hear the clip?
I do.
I do too. Right.
Do I get two votes?
You certainly do. You're the director. That's Democracy in Action. 4-0. Here's the clip.
So she's friendly, this great aunt of mine.
You'll like her.
Will you please stop ringing that damn bell?
After a while, she's kind of an acquired taste.
Right.
What
Eleanor?
Well, for the love of Thomas Hardy.
That, of course, being the famous Dame Helen Mirren, by whom I was famously handbagged at the BAFTAs not a year ago now, playing the sort of slightly scary, but actually after a while kind of taking the edges off aunt, who owns this extraordinary library, which is then becomes sort of central part of the narrative. And the thing I said before when Paul Bettany was in was, it does basically star a roll call of all my favourite British actors. I mean, Paul Bettany, you know, I'm a huge fan of anyway, and Ian was kind enough to send me a text from Germany saying, we're in Germany, I'm here with Paul Bettany. I'm sending back a text which says, say he was very good, but Da Vinci Code is still a load of old pants. But of course, I think Paul himself seems to agree with that. And then Andy Serkis, who's never puts a foot wrong. I mean, literally never puts a foot
apart
wrong.
Apart from in that film that you slagged him off in.
No, I
didn't slag the movie off.
No, that's a
you didn't like The Cottage. He was very disappointed that you didn't like The Cottage.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't like it. It's not his fault that I didn't like it, but I didn't like it. And then, of course, Helen Mirren, who does this kind of slightly scary aunt character, but then after a while, sort of the edges come off her slightly.
Very funny, because Helen came with the idea, which is different from the version of Aunt Eleanor in the book. She's described as a rather kind of portly woman, and Helen said, I'm not going to play a portly woman. She had this idea that she was going to be more sort of intellectual and feisty and kind of eccentric, and modelled it on this English eccentric Edith Sitwell. She wore a turban, and the call I got from the studio sort of 2 hours before the first shot I did in the film at 5 a.m. wasn't good luck, Ian. It was good luck, Ian, eventually, but it was, you know, can you take her turban off? And I said, well, it's a bit late now, and you know, et cetera, and it's going to be interesting. So when I called Helen after we had a very good test screening in America, and I said, you know, and they loved you, the part of Eleanor was great, and her comment was, so no problem with the turban then.
Just to clear up one thing we should have done before, Cornelia Funke wanted you very much to be the director, because she says, I've got the quote here somewhere, I mean, she was particular, she was a huge fan of Wings of a Dove, and she thought that you, Wings of the Dove, and she thought, having seen that, you'd be the man for this. I mean, is that how it worked out?
It is, yeah. I mean, and I couldn't really understand what the kind of association in her mind was when I read the script, because the script was very sort of spare and was all just the interior scenes, whereas when I went back to the book, I realised that she had written the book in this area of Italy on the French border, very mountainous, full of lots of castles and ruined towns, incredibly atmospheric, and her book is full of these descriptions of and the sense of place. It's kind of quite gritty, and so I put a lot of that back into the screenplay, and I think it actually did end up having, you know, a lot more similarities with Wings of the Dove than when I first saw the screenplay.
Because Cornelia is a producer on the programme as well. Does that mean that she's sort of over your shoulder going, don't do that?
It's funny how many people think that's the case. I mean, I was a producer as well, and there was a third producer on the film. But I mean, she wasn't on the set all the time by any means. She came to Italy a few times, and she didn't come to London that much. And during the whole 6 month pre-production, we were, you know, doing all the visual effects and all the concept work. She would pop in from time to time. She was just very supportive. It was more that she was like another member of our team who had the clout to sort of, you know, she supported the idea that I had, which was to sort of retain some of the darkness from the book. And, you know, the discussions were always with, you know, the requirements of the studio to make it as, you know, commercial, you know, in their mind.
The good doctor is here, and the good Ian Softley is here. What qualifications do you have, Ian? Very important on this show.
I'd like to have a doctorate.
No, it's not what you'd like to have, Ian, is what you've actually got.
What I have,
how far
I've
did
got,
you actually ascend to?
I didn't ascend to. I got an MA, which the university I went to, they just gave you. You just needed to sort of turn up. I actually didn't turn up. I was sent it in the post.
Did you get an MA? What did you get before that?
A BA.
Well, there you go. So you work for the BA, and then you got the MA for fun.
But the MA, because they do that forgive me for knowing this, but I think they do that. Did you go to Oxford or Cambridge?
I went to Cambridge.
Oh, you see. But that's it. It's the Cambridge thing. It's like, oh, yes, you're still alive 2 years later. Of course, you have learned so much, you must obviously have an MA.
Completely
and it's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense.
That's the reason I didn't turn up for the actual ceremony.
He, on the other hand, got given a doctorate.
I got a doctorate.
They gave it to him.
Who gave you one?
Warwick University.
Blimey.
I'm a doctor of D-Lit. Doctor of Letters.
So made just, up Doctor of Letters.
He is looking at me with greater respect than you are.
Yeah, this is great. I'm actually in the room with two people, both of whom scammed higher qualifications.
That's the way it goes.
Okay?
Grant in Glasgow. Dear Mark and Lard, I listen every week, as does my girlfriend Vicky, who introduced me to your show. Could you get her to stop blowing her nose on her pants? As I'm sure you'll agree, it's a disgusting habit. This is the way the movie correspondence has gone. It's got nothing to do with movies. It's just that you're a figure of sort of responsibility.
Okay, stop blowing your nose. I can't believe anyone even does that.
A lot of excitement building up for the new Keanu Reeves movie. Are you a fan of Keanu Reeves in?
Keanu Reeves. Yeah, I am a fan of Keanu Reeves. The Matrix. He was terrific in The Matrix. I can't imagine anybody else.
Keanu Reeves' best role was in Johnny Mnemonic, in which he played a man who has so much space in his brain that people are able to use it to store other information.
Speed. He was good in Speed.
He was. He just had to say, stop, go slur.
And a very fine film. Anyway, some movies to discuss, including The Day the Earth Stood Still, Dean Spanley. What else do we have to do before?
Oh, The Man from London, the Bellatar movie, which I need to talk about because I sat through it in Cannes and then it was a long time ago.
But Inkheart is where we are. Inkheart is Ian's. In fact, we were talking about you. Angelina Jolie was on a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about Changeling, which I like very much. You can still watch the interview on YouTube, like a million hits or something like that.
Was it as popular as my interview with Angelina Jolie?
Was she admitting to doing Hackers? Because there's a 2008 version of Angelina Jolie, which is different from the kind of 2007 and all the preceding years, where she was very ready to acknowledge the fact that Hackers was her big break. But I think something's kind of changed. I think
143,000 people have watched it, and but that was her debut, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Essentially. And yeah. Mark, in fact, we were talking about this last week. Why were we talking about?
Well, the reason this came up is because the minute, as the listeners may know, I'm a huge fan of Ian's. I mean, I'm not just saying this because he's here, because I go on about Ian a lot when he's not here. I mean, I think Ian is one of Britain's best
directors.
In a slightly
obsessive way, Ian.
No, I know, in a slightly obsessive, slightly creepy.
I'm not worried about that at all.
But frankly, I just live with it. Okay. Yeah. And very early on, Ian made Backbeat, and then I think it was immediately after Backbeat, wasn't it? It was Hackers. Yeah. And Simon loved Hackers. I loved Hackers. And Nigel Floyd of London's Time Out, the only magazine apparently that I ever read,
along with the Guardian,
loved it as well. Apart from that, it wasn't sort of very widely seen. But I sort of flew the flag for it very much.
In fact, in Germany, by the way, whenever I go to Germany, I get given Hackers things to sign.
Excellent,
as earlier this week.
But the achievement of it, as we mentioned just the other day, is the fact that when you go back and you watch old movies which sort of revolve around computers and technology, they date very quickly.
Look rubbish.
But if you go back and watch Hackers, hasn't dated at all. It still looks great.
And in fact, it found its audience later on what was then the very cutting-edge technology of laser disc. People would go and buy the Hackers laser disc. But this was Angelina Jolie's big break, and of course it was the big break. And I remember when I saw it, I had no idea who she was, and I said, she's great, who's that woman? And you said, believe me, she's going to be a star. And then now, of course, the Changeling stuff is happening, and I'm not sure that she's quite so keen to be remembered as the person who was the stroppy punky girl in Hackers. But the hilarious thing is, she came to Britain. She was interviewed by me for the culture. I said, Angelina, love Hackers, let's talk about Hackers. She was interviewed by you. You said, I love Hackers, let's talk about Hackers. She was interviewed on stage by Nigel Floyd. He said, love Hackers. That was it. She must think the whole of Britain is a Hackers appreciation society.
And this email from Jamie, currently resident in the Isle of Man, BA honours, MA, etc.
Excellent.
Dear Quiff and Quiffless, Angelina may have praised Dr. K's hair, but she could only see the front of him. Those of us who watched his local hero location interview with Bill Forsyth noted a distinct thinning around the crown in a certain light. As he trundles towards 50, the hairless area will inevitably expand. Well, what we want to know is, what action will the good doctor take? Will he, one, apply copious amounts of oil, plastering the hair at the front backwards over the balding crown? Two, do what a number of old rock and rollers do, keep the quiff at the front but shift the parting at the back to somewhere near his ear, in the style of Bobby Charlton. Or three, do what many celebrities do and have artificial hair glued, bonded, woven into his own hair to create the illusion of a full head of hair.
Well, I don't understand how this relates to Ian and Hackers, but a very simple, or Inkheart even. Very simple answer to that question, which is this. Teds are the only people who, the older and more knackered they get, the better they look. There was a guy who used to walk up and down the main shopping street in Manchester. He had a little bit of hair at the front, two little bits of hair at the side, and they were all greased back, and they met in a sort of three-way DA at the back, and he had this old grey drape coat, and on the back of it said clapped out old rocker, and that's who I want to be as I grow older.
And the reason why I mentioned it at that time, even though perfectly fair and reasonable of you to question my production and editorial decisions at that point,
go ahead,
is precisely because who was it who mentioned your hair?
Angelina Jolie.
There you go. And oh, that's why. That's where it came
up. Who isn't in Incot?
Who isn't in Incot? Let's get back onto that. So here's what.
Where would you have put her if you could have cast her? Anywhere. What role would she have had?
Well, if
you can make one of the next books, because there's three.
In fact, we heard in Germany that they were being very gung ho, and they said that because you know Cornelia Funke, the writer of the book, is a big phenomenon in Germany. Yeah. They said that if it does as well as they think it's going to do in Germany and hopefully in the UK, then it doesn't matter how well it does in America. They will commission number 2 and 3, which is great because they kind of get weirder and more exciting. And as I think with the Potter books, as the characters get older, they deal with more sort of teens and adolescent and eventually adult stories. And there's some wonderful characters and supernatural elements in the second book, Ink Spell. These white ladies that whenever anybody's approaching death, because death is actually quite a subject that's dealt with a lot in Funke's books, you see these wispy women kind of coming towards you, almost like kind of something out of Native American mythology. There's a great character called the Black Prince and the Adderhead, who's a kind of another villain. And all of the characters end up in Inkworld. Eleanor ends up, Fareed takes Meggie in there, and there's a kind of little increasing flirtation between Meggie and Fareed. She then has another kind of potential lover. Mo goes back, and his wife Risa goes back as well. So all the characters in separate stories sort of meet and separate, and it's a really incredible world. There's an amazing scene in there that I think was one of the reasons that Paul Bettany decided to do the role, which is he has his wife called Roxanne, played by his real wife Jennifer Connelly, and she has a small sort of little cameo in Inkheart to sort of anticipate her larger role in the second movie. And as he's setting off on a quest that he and she thinks will lead to his death, he writes in fire, being a fire eater, he writes her name in fire on the sea before he gallops off. So there's incredibly kind of much more sort of visionary elements to the second and third stories.
Well, hopefully 2 and 3 will turn up, and hopefully you'll get the gig to do those.
We've all got this pact, but I don't think anybody's going to do them unless the people that were involved. Because it was an incredible kind of panoply of British British talent, both sides of the camera. We had Roger Pratt, an amazing cinematographer.
Who's a brilliant DP, yeah.
Martin Walsh, who did Backbeat for me, who I worked with when I worked with Tony Wilson in Manchester. And Martin won the Oscar for Chicago. And he did Inkheart. John Beard, amazing designer, has done 5 movies with me. And then all the actors, as well as the people we talked about, there's Jim Broadbent, there's John Thompson, and Jamie Foreman, and Matt Snow. So all of these, this great British cast, and we're all dying to get back together to do the second and third.
Did you know early on in whether you wanted to instinctively stick very closely to the book, because that's what made it a popular book, or to have a slightly freer adaptation and just go with what would make a good film? Did you know what you wanted to do?
Yeah, well, I hadn't read the book first, so when I read the script, I mean, I liked it. I liked the characters and the narrative, and I thought there was this great combination of kind of comedy and fantasy and kind of some interesting ideas about, parallel realities, the life of the imagination, and indeed reading. But it was, as I said, it was when I read the books that I realised that there was much more kind of texture to them. But Cornelia Funke herself, the writer, was involved in the development of this screenplay that was very different from her book. So I knew right from the beginning that she was very open to a kind of, to being quite loose with the adaptation, which was a great kind of freedom to have as a director.
The interesting thing with the film is that, because I know it's been finished for a while, when you were doing it, I think it must have turned out better than they had expected, and consequently that then meant that they delayed the release because they thought that it would be a bigger hit. I wonder, did that put any pressure on you? Because you talked this thing about, making it as wide an audience as possible. And one of the things I really like, and I really like Inkheart, I think it's a really terrific film in the way in which an entire family can genuinely go and see it. But often that means, okay, well, you've got to satisfy a wide audience. Did they put any pressure on you to do anything? Because it looks to me like the film you set out to make.
Well, I think what happened is we were making it literally next door to the Golden Compass,
and I think which went so well,
and it was an incredible distraction to New Line, and it meant that we were given a lot of rope that we could have hung ourselves with, and the jury will be out on that one. I mean, we're very proud of the film that we've made, but I think that it was On the one hand, it meant that, you know, the budget was very tight because a lot of money had been spent on the Golden Compass, and that was really the kind of the vanguard, the company were putting all their hopes in. But the advantage to us was that we were slightly kind of under the radar. And I think it's absolutely the case that we were really allowed to, you know, to get on and make the film that we wanted to make. And I mean, I went in for my first meeting with the studio, and I said, "I want Jim Broadbent, Paul Bettany, and Helen Mirren." And then, you know, luckily, I was able to convince them to do it. But I think that's a good point. That it is the film that I wanted to make. I mean, originally they said you've got to make it in Eastern Europe and Croatia. You've got to shoot the studio in Eastern Europe, and you've got to shoot the location, which is Italy, in Croatia. And I went immediately to Liguria and realised how important it was in telling the story, this juxtaposition of the ancient medieval world, 20 minutes away sometimes from, you know, the 21st century, and you know, the Italian Riviera and motorways and airports and things. And I argued that, you know, that's where we had to make it. And I think that a lot of those decisions we were able to do because there wasn't that much attention on us.
This email from Richard says, "Mark, Simon and Ian, I got the Hacker's Laserdisc imported from Japan for about £55.
See?
It remains one of my favourite movies. You guys are correct. It hasn't dated with its depiction of technology, unlike some I could mention. Say hello to The Net."
Oh, yeah, with Sandra Bullock.
And Jeremy Northam, I think, who was on.
There's Jeremy Northam, who I like very much.
And I'm convinced it will go down as one of the great cult pictures of the 90s. Thanks for your body of work, Ian. Also a huge fan of K-Pax. Would it be rude, he says, to ask what your next project will be? Hopefully not, because that's what I'm
going
to
ask.
There were
more K-Pax books as well. At one point, you talked about doing some other of those.
Jeff Bridges was very keen to do the second book, which was called On a Beam of Light. I don't know why. I mean, I think that it was much more just, you know, even more than the first one, contained within the psychiatrist's office. So yeah. I think that it was kind of less appealing to me. It was actually a very, very interesting book. And I think there's a third one after that, which I haven't read. But my next film is something I've adapted myself. It's a book written by Sébastien Jeprisot, who wrote A Very Long Engagement.
Which was filmed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet.
Jean-Pierre Jeunet with Audrey Tautou.
Audrey Tautou!
And we're...
Typical, you know, just standard French accent there.
No, but she's in Da Vinci Code. She deserves it. Anyone who's in that movie deserves to be laughed at, apart from Paul Bettany, although particularly for that film.
It's called Trap for Cinderella, and it's murder, mystery, obsession, identity switch, and it's sexy and takes place in Paris and the south of France.
And if Inkheart goes well, because I mean, actually, some of the reviews have been very good. As I said, it was film of the week and that thing. And of course, one British critic who's remained nameless said to me after he'd seen this film, he said, "Have you seen Inkheart?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, I really liked it." And he went, "Good, good." Because I think there's always that weird thing. Critics have a big problem with getting behind, you know, PG certificate fare that they think that everybody, they're not sure whether it's all right to like it. Actually, also slightly beneficial to you that for various peculiar reasons the Potter movie ended up being put back, because in a way Inkheart has stepped into that space, because otherwise you wouldn't want to be head to head with the Harry Potter movie.
So that's worked out quite well. And at the risk of blowing too many trumpets all at once, Lewin Chorley, I first heard about Inkheart when it was reviewed on Simon's Book Review a few years ago. I went out that day and bought it for my kids. They were too young to appreciate it at the time, but my daughter, who's now 10, has just read it. Can't wait to see the film. And she concludes, "All this proves if you want to keep ahead, there's only one show to listen to."
It also proves that, I mean, because my daughter is 10 years old as well and has read the book and absolutely is just desperate to see the film. And I was very nervous going to see it, partly because I really like Ian's work anyway, and partly because you're going to see it thinking, I hope this is going to be. And actually, the thing that I really liked about it, as I do think there is a great dearth of terrific family entertainment, and it was really good to see a film that was intelligent, smartly put together, properly put together, a proper film, but that actually was genuinely acceptable for that audience, didn't have all the stuff that makes it not work for a younger audience.
I think the clue is that, you know, it's sort of sometimes called a children's film, but there's only two teenagers in it and everybody else is adults.
Yes.
It's not like there's this great cast of kids. I mean, the other thing that I think is quite important to know when you see the movie is that Eliza Bennett, who plays Maggie, the lead, who's a fantastic new actress.
She sings
the end song. And I think that you know, the effect of hearing her sing that end song is much more significant when you know that it's actually the character in the movie singing it. And there's a we did a music video a few days ago, and you can see that on the internet.
Great. Ian, really appreciate you coming in. Thanks very much indeed. Inkheart, it sounds like a good Christmas holiday banker.
That's exactly what we hope it is.
Excellent. So we have a box office top 10 this week at 10, The Children.
You know, which is genuinely scary and creepy and unsettling. Funny, when I first saw it, I wasn't entirely sure whether or not I liked it, because it was, and that's the right reaction you should get from a horror film, is that you feel slightly uneasy in its presence. And it's a story about, you know, people go on holiday to a cottage for Christmas, and the children turn out to be the village of the damned, and a whole bunch of weird stuff happens in a way that seems much more explicit than it actually is, because it is in the end only a 15-minute film, but it is genuinely creepy in that great tradition of paedophobic you know, horror movies, which of course Britain has always done rather well.
High School Musical 3, Senior Year, this
it's
week's number
just
9.
Just so great to see it still hanging on in there in the charts. It is definitely one of my top five of the year. There's a couple of people have written in saying, you know, you've completely lost the plot. What is it with that and Mamma Mia? But there is a big difference. And bear this in mind. I said that Mamma Mia was so bad, it's brilliant. The case of High School Musical 3, it is just brilliant. And have you taken your kids to see it?
No.
Why did you say it so harshly?
Because they're not interested.
Oh, OK. Fine. They're too old.
Yeah, or not interested.
Okay. No, well, he does, yes, in a slightly more abrasive way than I'd perhaps
expected.
Just
say no.
No, okay. Yeah, but you see, it was the way you said
no. Oh, no.
Yeah, have you seen it yourself? Because you'd really enjoy it. It's really good. Go see it. It's terrific fun.
My best friend's girl at 8.
Is really bad. Don't go and see it.
Lakeview Terrace at 7?
Lakeview Terrace. When we put the One review a week we put up on the intraweb so that you can see it afterwards, and it went up just due to an editorial error. It went up as Lakeside Terrace, and a couple of people wrote in to say it's not a shopping centre somewhere. Anyway, Lakeview Terrace, new movie by Neil LaBute, whose career has been very much up and down. This is one of the up ones. Unbelievably caused in some places a stink about potential racism, which it clearly isn't. Standout performance by Samuel Jackson, essentially a B-movie about a family who move in next door to a cop, and the cop turns out to be more psycho than all the people he is meant to be keeping watch on. And it does go mad in the end, but there's a good 85 minutes of it in which it keeps a lid on it very well.
Body of Lies at number 6.
My only major advice to Ridley Scott, and I'm sure that he's listening and hanging on my every word, finding out how to get his career on track, is that he should make less films. There was a point when he made films so irregularly.
Fewer films, I think.
Oh, I beg your pardon. No, you're quite right. It's less water and fewer films, isn't it? It's a whole bunch
of water.
He can make less water as well. Viewers are invited to, listeners are invited to insert their own cheap gag there. And it's fine, but it's no more than fine. And I think of Ridley Scott as a world maker. He's the kind of guy who does the world of Blade Runner or the world of Alien or the world of Gladiator even.
World of Leather.
Yes, I just don't want one film every year. You're particularly cheeky today.
Sorry about that. Quantum of Solace is at number 5.
Oh,
I think we've already done that. Changeling at 4. Tom Wateracre says, Re-Changeling, dear Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I think it's also... anyway, he says, the next time Kermode sees Clint Eastwood, could he politely suggest that for his next film, he employs an actual composer so we are spared the awful noodling of Clint and his jazz buddies on the soundtrack? I also think it's worth pointing out that Changeling is a really bad date movie. Although, speaking as the man who took someone on a first date to see Angela's Ashes, I should have seen that one coming.
Blimey. A first and only date, probably. The issue of Clint Eastwood and music is very interesting because, of course, Clint is a musician. And, I mean, you think of the great films he's been... I mean, you think, for example, of Play Misty for Me, in which is, you know, a central component of that is the music. I think that's one of the very few films I can remember in which you actually see somebody putting on a record and then listen to them playing it. I mean, obviously, it's also a plot point in the thing, but I think his music's pretty interesting.
And we have Transporter 3 at 3.
Jason Statham.
Greg, NVQ Level 2 in customer service. It's not that it means anything, he says. Having taken the good doctor's advice last week, I took the Mrs. C Transporter 3, expecting growling dialogue, oiled torsos and a general thriller-minute experience. Sadly, I felt let down by Mark's failure to mention the sheer amount of screen time taken up by Jason Statham, or...
Jason Statham.
And the Ukrainian actress, whose name escapes me, but I shall call Maria Freckled All Over. Yeah. It was downright soppy and ruined all the momentum of the story. Even my girlfriend found it too much, and she's a woman, Greg points out. The film did have some subtitles, so maybe that skewed your review to the positive. Still enjoying the program. Hang on a second. Dear Pebbles and Bam Bam, when Transporter 3 came out, I saw that 2 was being shown on 5, or whatever the channel is called these days, so I watched it. I thought it was rubbish. Yours every Friday between 3 and 4. Lisa, BSc Finance and International Business.
Transporter 2 is the weakest of the three. Somebody else wrote in and reminded me that there's a scene in, I think it's the first Transporter movie, in which Jason Statham has to kiss this bloke underwater. And the plot contrivance to it, because bear in mind, one of the key lines in Transporter 3 is she says, "Oh, I know, you are the gay." And he says, "I'm not the gay." But in the first Transporter movie, he's underwater with this bloke and he's drowning, right? He's run out of air. So what can he do but suck the air out of the other guy's lungs? And how else is he going to do it? But with of course, you know, I mean, people who are seeing something homoerotic in this are just clearly overreading the text.
Four Christmases at 2.
Rubbish. I mean, it's, you know, here it comes. It's Christmas. It's Vince Vaughn. Shall we all just boycott Vince Vaughn for Christmas? Because in the end, Vince Vaughn isn't just for Christmas. He's for life. And this is going to carry on happening every time somebody goes, you know, "Oh, coming up to Christmas, nothing on the cinema. Let's go see that Four Christmases," you know. And then all you're doing is encouraging him to do it again next year. Because last year it was not Bad Santa. What was it called? Fred Claus. Fred Claus, in which he plays Santa's unlovable brother. And boy, does he do the unlovable well.
And the number one movie this week is Madagascar, Escape to Africa.
I mean,
got to move it.
Yeah, but you see, that's it. And, of course, when they sat down with their balance sheets to do Madagascar 2, which is perfectly fine, OK? I mean, when I saw the first Madagascar, I have to confess, I wasn't wowed by it. I thought the funniest thing in it was Sacha Baron Cohen. Clearly the makers thought the same thing, because Sacha Baron Cohen features very heavily in the second film, and all his stuff is the funniest thing. But I know that, you know, it's very, very popular with young kids, and good for it. And in the case of Madagascar 2, they clearly sat down and went, that bit worked a little bit more, let's do all of them again. And one of the things that they figured worked it was that you just did. And
you've got to move it.
Exactly. So they've kind of gone, "Can we do that again?" "No, it's fine, yeah, because Sasha's coming back, we can do that." And so they do that again, only, you know, it's kind of like more of the same, only slightly different, but not different enough to warrant. I mean, it's not a great film, but it's a perfectly acceptable bit of poly filler.
So many emails already
on
the day the earth
stood still.
Should that be our first?
It should.
Stopping
our
off
first
point?
And perhaps only, because there are times when a director covers everything so well in a film that there's really nothing else to say. And I think in the case of the day the earth stood still, it's something that should cause us all to stop and reflect.
Are we building up ahead of steam?
No, I'm giving it the awe that it deserves.
Just a quick point from Jerry in Belfast.
Do you know the gag about John Wayne?
Yes.
Oh, fine.
So let's not do it again. Jerry in Belfast says, "I thought you might appreciate hearing about the film Dead Snow, if you haven't already been exposed to its Norwegian madness." Have you heard about this?
I haven't, no.
"From what I can gather from the trailer, this film contains zombie Nazis who are then attacked with chainsaws and possibly snowmobiles. And I propose that this is the movie with the most potential for 2009. Can you think of anything better?"
Well, the one that I'm really looking forward to is Iron Sky, which is a film that has been in development for a very long time. People will know there's an internet site for it that they're sort of doing it. And the story is, in 1945, Nazis went to the moon. In 2009... they're coming back. And the story is that Nazis have been living on the other side of the moon ever since the end of World War II, and consequently their technology hasn't evolved, so they're still all in steam-driven spaceships. I'm sorry, doesn't that sound brilliant?
It sounds right. Fantastic.
The movie will probably stink, but, you know.
No, absolutely.
Mark in Exeter, "Dear Murtu and Riggs, I wait with bated breath for the review of The Day the Earth Stood Still. Should it be called, 'Hey Dude, Stop Like Messing Up the Planet?' I've tried my best to come up with a good wood-based Keanu Reeves pun after last week's Nicole Kindling, which is probably going to take
beating.
I saw it in the papers this week. That's all I could think of. It's Nicole Kindling.
Nicole Kindling in Australia.
But I failed so far. Trianu Reeves is all I could come up with. If anyone is keeping the score, in my humble opinion, Matthew Mahogany is the best so far." James in Surrey, "Dear Mario and Luigi, I wrote last week asking..." asking whether The Happening was the least descriptive film title ever. "Now I have a new question. Is Keanu Reeves the most efficient actor of our time? He's managed to extract an entire career out of a single facial expression. If this isn't masterful acting, it must at least be business genius. My friends and I have become so fascinated with this minimalist approach that I have let out an audible exclamation of glee when I first saw him in the trailer for his latest effort. Specifically, I called out the word acting in delight."
Can I just say, if you go to my website, the bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode, there is me attempting to pay facial tribute, this can't be done on the radio, to Keanu's wide-ranging facial expressions in, like, The Day the Earth Stood Still, dude. And Please check it out.
The review is imminent. Dan Brusker on this email says, "Dear Sexy and the Beast, I expect the good doctor will despise the day the earth stood still and excoriate it accordingly. But please go easy on Jennifer Connelly. It's her birthday today and she's lovely." Dan says, "Birthday shout outs to Tom Wilkinson, who's 60, and Bill Nye, who's 59.
And while we're here, shall we do the hellos?
Take
hello,
it away.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
Hello to Stephen. I've just written down Steve. Was that Stephen Fry?
I thought you were going to say Stephen Patrick Morrissey there.
No. David Morrissey.
Okay.
All of Fairport Convention, Focus, Ken Branner. Is that it? Dumpy's Rusty Nuts.
Dumpy's Rusty Nuts, yes. Billy from the Subways, who now has a quiff.
Are you going to go easy on Jennifer Connelly or not?
Well, should we do the film first, okay? Rather than just sort of honing in on her performance. Okay, Jennifer Connelly is a perfectly decent actress, and of course she's married to Paul Bettany, so therefore she must be entirely good. Well, her judgment must be entirely good. So look, here's just the nuts and bolts stuff, okay? It's a remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still, the 1950s classic. And in the original, Michael Rennie, have you ever seen the Rocky Horror Picture Show?
Yes.
Somebody incidentally sent in an email, and this relates to this. It says, "Dear Rossi and Parfit, I think I just heard Simon Mayo sing, 'Please Don't Ever Again, Paul,' in London. I got to move it. At the very beginning
of singing.
No, that's exactly what I think he was implying. At the very beginning of the Rocky Horror Show, it goes, "Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still." And that's the opening line of Rocky Horror, obviously. And famously,
excuse me, Helen. You just told me off for singing, and then in the next sentence, you sing.
But what I did was a very interesting impression of Richard O'Brien, and what you did was a very bad impression. Thank you, Brian. Oh, I like Elliot Smith.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Michael Rennie comes down to Earth because the Earth is on the brink of kind of, you know, people destroying each other with weapons.
It?
Was, not is, oh. Was. Wait, dude. Okay, no, wait, okay, man, because things have changed, like, in some ways, but in other ways, you know, they're just, like, just the same, okay? So he comes down to Earth, and the whole point is he stops everything. Hence, the day the Earth stood still,
because
the Earth literally stands still, okay? In this one, Kiananunu comes to Earth to stop mankind from destroying the planet, what with his eco-unfriendliness and everything. And before I go any further, let me just tell you from the press notes for the movie that it says, as a part of 20th Century Fox parent company News Corp's corporate mandate to become a carbon-neutral company, The Day the Earth Stood Still was chosen to be the studio's first green production. And then it says, very importantly here, where it was necessary to use lumber, it was sourced from sustainably managed forests, or Keanu Reeves, as they're also known. Thank you very much. You've been a lovely audience. Don't forget to tip your waitress. So Keanu comes down to Earth, and he says, "Look, man, you know everything's going really badly. You're all sort of destroying the planet, and you've got to stop doing
Neil
it."
Neil from the Young Ones.
Yeah, it is. Here's the thing. Clearly, in attempting to play the role, what Keanu Reeves has done is the quote that he used was, he said Michael Rennie played him as an alien with a human body, right? But Keanu played him as an alien in a human body, which I think you'll admit is a very clear distinction. Oddly enough, Keanu believes that an alien in a human body would talk just like Spock out of Star Trek. Don't believe me? Listen to this clip in which Kinanununu discusses the future of the human race with a scientist who has won a Nobel Prize for basically being great, which is essentially the same as the prize that Dr. Hofer got for being a genius. And Keanu, in this, completely epitomises the alien nature of his character, whilst John Cleese is the human in us all.
There must be alternatives. You must have some technology that could solve our problem.
Your problem is not technology. The problem is you. You lack the will to change.
Then help us change.
I cannot change your nature. You treat the world as you treat each other.
But every civilization reaches a crisis point eventually.
Most of them don't make it.
Yours did? How?
Our sun was dying. We had to evolve in order to survive.
So it was only when your world was threatened with destruction that you became what you are now?
Yes.
Well, that's where we are. You say we're on the brink of destruction, and you're right. But it's only on the brink that people find the will to change. Only at the precipice do we evolve. This is our moment. Don't take it from us. We are close to an answer.
This has been a party political broadcast on behalf of the John Cleese Party. Now, I'm sorry, it's very hard, not when he says, you know, I cannot change the way you are. That is illogical, Captain. He is clearly doing an impression of Leonard Nimoy in Star
Trek.
Did
sound like that.
He's sat there, but listen to Keanu's description of what he's doing, okay?
Don't do it in a Keanu.
I'm not going to, because nobody can do that. Nobody can do Keanu. Okay. I tried to bring objectivity to the camera and the way he to the character and the way he observes everything around him. There is a kind of compression in Klaatu. You know, of course, he's called Klaatu. Yes. He is an alien entity contained in a human body, and when he is looking out of that body, he is just looking out. But over the course of the film, he is gradually affected by the people around him, and he experiences what it means to be human. Now, I know that the obvious thing to say is to get a film in which somebody who clearly grapples so much with the concept of being human at all, Keanu Reeves, is a brilliant piece of casting. And funnily enough, when this came up, because I know it's directed by Scott Derrickson, and it's been reported that Scott Derrickson was a big fan of the original film, and he went to see Robert Wise years and years ago, and Robert Wise said, you know, if you want to get on in genre filmmaking, the thing you need to do first off is to make a horror movie. And Derrickson worked on Exorcism of Emily Rose, which was a perfectly interesting, if kind of rather hyper adaptation of a true story, which was also filmed as Requiem, the German movie, which is absolutely brilliant. And he's clearly been had a respectful and reverential attitude towards the original Day the Earth Stood Still. And what they've attempted to do is to update it to say, you know, the problem now isn't to do with man blowing up man, the problem is to do with man destroying the planet. And you know what? It's not your planet, it's everybody else's planet, and you've got to look after it. And somewhere in the back of this, when this was coming out, I thought, you know what? Actually, Keanu Reeves is quite a good idea for that. Because one of the funny things about Keanu Reeves is that kind of planky quality that he has. That how much of Keanu Reeves' performance would you like me to saw off might actually do rather well for a character who is fundamentally not meant to have any human emotions and is, as he says in that little thing there, looking out of the human body. And yet, the amazing thing about it is after having done movie after movie after movie in which he basically plays a speaking wardrobe, now Keanu wrestles even with the playing the speaking wardrobe and falls into what can only be described as laugh out loud funny Star Trek pastiche. It's such a peculiar thing to see happening. And the scene in which John Cleese turns up as the, you know, the representative of all, you know, of all great humanity, because they start doing, you know, it's in, they start doing an equation together on the board, and John Cleese is obviously brilliant and Keanu Reeves is obviously, you know, a surfer pretending to be a space alien, and they develop this dialogue, which is the dialogue that you've just heard there. It, you just think, this is actually an absurdist gag. You couldn't have made this scene more absurd. Now, on top of that, CGI. So Gort, who is now, Gort is turns out to be an acronym for something, which I can't, it's something with robotic transporter or geothermic, whatever it is. We come up with the acronym, backronym probably in that case, since his name was Gort before all that happened. It's a great big sort of CGI thingy, which doesn't have any of the sort of portentous quality of the original robot. And Keanu just does an awful lot of wandering around looking off in every scene like someone has just proverbially slapped him in the face with a wet fish. And during the course of the movie, he apparently gets in touch with his human side. But all that means is that he looks a little bit more squinty than he did at the beginning of the film. And as these human emotions boil up inside him and he responds to the love in Jennifer Connelly and he responds to the humanity of Jennifer Connelly, he just looks a little bit more like he doesn't actually know what day of the week it is. I mean, it's clear that what Scott Derrickson did was he said, you know, Keanu, get into the physicality of the performance. Remember, it's like you're not connected properly to the front of your body. You'd think he'd be perfect for that. But oddly enough, you just think, no, you know what, Keanu, like you as I do, you can't act.
Tom Cohen, BA, MBA, and captain of the Highway Code team in primary school. Dear Colonel K and Danger Mouse, went to see an advanced screening of The Day My Mind Stood Still yesterday.
Very good.
As I was down with man flu. Even with a head full of cold, I felt too intelligent for this 90 minutes of half-witted drivel. Keanu was as good as usual, insert own gag good here. And John Cleese must really have had an expensive divorce to agree to this. Andrew in Aberdeen. This film made me feel I was being told off for something.
You are. Being told off.
What I was being told off for and how I could prevent doing it again in the future wasn't explicitly discussed, though, which, in my humble opinion, is a cop-out. They could at least have copied the happy hippie ending of An Inconvenient Truth, where it told us exactly what it was we should be doing. Make friends with nature, hug a tree, use Triffid oil in your car. This film made me feel as though I was suffering an epic commodian rant without any of the wit-tainment. Wait.
Sorry.
Sandy from the Bridge of Allen. Dear Klaatu and Gort, saw this travesty on Wednesday in London. Not a patch on the original, no atmosphere, no sympathy for the protagonists, too much reliance on special effects. Sadly, Keanu, who I like a lot and generally am sympathetic to, has totally misunderstood the character he is playing, and or the director has lost the plot. Humans can't destroy helicopters by sending energy up their laser beams, and Keanu is supposed to be incarnated inside a human body. I can suspend disbelief, but this is taking the proverbial. The film is awful, but I finally gave up on it when Keanu decided to change his mind about obliterating the human race after witnessing human grief. He should have done his research
exactly better. Exactly. It's like we said, you know, we've been studying your planet for centuries. Really? You not watch television? He says, oh, you have emotions. Yeah, what were you watching? The X Factor? I mean, for heaven's sake, how do you not know this?
Sandy concludes, the portrayal of Americans as trigger-happy morons will please some, but plays us all as gullible fools. What a load of dross. Neil... Dear Doctor and the Medics, I returned to the cinema to watch The Day the Earth Stood Still with a friend of mine for the first time in a long time, as I've grown accustomed to waiting for the DVD. The trailer looked so impressive, I felt drawn in like a tractor beam to the advanced screening of this film. I'm a big fan of the original black and white movie and was interested to see the 21st century take on this classic tale, as it has more relevance now than it ever did when it was first made. What a waste of 104 minutes. It was terrible. The trailer contained all the good bits. The special effects were confusing and at most times unnecessary. The cast was unimpressive. I'm trying to remember more of the bad points, but because the film is that bad and that unmemorable, my brain has already started to remove the memory of the film from my head.
Like Johnny Mnemonic.
I felt like asking for my money back. And Chris, ARCM, DIP, RCM, BAMA, we're not fans of Mr. Reeve here. In our house, we call him Mr. Key. Ah, no.
That's very good. Can I say three other things very quickly? Scott Derrickson said that the Keanu Reeves performance, right, the way he develops from alien into human, he said, this is a quote, he said it's all about, he captured the experience of being human and recognising in his alien superiority what it is about humanity that is remarkable. To do that without being overwrought or overly dramatic is very difficult. And Keanu did it with an amazing amount of nuance, which just put me in mind of that Spinal Tap thing about, you know, it's too much perspective. It's so nuanced that you can't actually see it happen at all. Also, the score, one of the best things about the original score was the battling theremins, right? Theremin, fantastic. That effectively set in motion what we now think of as science fiction scores, the Bernard Herrmann score. Terrible music this time round, which apparently reimagines the Bernard Herrmann score, but I can't hear how. Other thing is, this time the spaceships, right? Keanu Reeves comes down to Earth in a huge collection of balls. And again, it is a kind of matter of trees, recyclable forests, write your own gag about the method of transport. There is just one great, big, glowing special effects ball in the middle of... And it's almost as if like the filmmakers have sat down and thought, how can we make people laugh out loud at this? And finally, the short story... I was sitting next to Kim Newman when I was watching the film, and Kim Newman was cross before the credits had ended at the beginning because he said, typical... They do that, and they don't even credit the short story on which the film was originally made, the Harry Bates short story, and he's actually quite true.
Reverend Rick Simpson, you remember we started this whole thing with an email from someone who just wanted you to tell off his other half for blowing her nose
on her
pants.
Underpants, yes.
Dear Jake and Elwood, says Rick Simpson, about your earlier text about his girlfriend and her pants, I thought it was only my wife who blew her nose on her pants, but clearly not. It really should stop, shouldn't it? I'm assuming that these are separate pants to the ones you're wearing, or maybe... Maybe not. Maybe there's a lot of this going on.
You know what I think? I think it would have been really good if Keanu's character, to demonstrate his dawning humanity, had taken his pants off and blown his nose on them, but done it almost as if he hadn't noticed he was doing it.
What's coming next?
We do the Bellatar movie. And we need to do Dean Spanley, because you had Jeremy Northam on. Yeah. So Dean Spanley and The Man from London.
Gareth, listening in Williams Lake in Canada. Dear Steve N and Steve Ann, as our country's constitutional crisis lurches from absurd assertion to another, I'm trying to take solace in your advent calendar, which I've been looking forward to all year. Unfortunately, it appears to have been infected with a little bit of Canadian federalism. In other words, it doesn't work. Most of the YouTube vignettes are no longer available, so I turn to our national radio, the CBC, and I'm stuck listening to the collective wit of our pompous Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition. Anyway, it goes on and on and on about this. Gareth, thanks for listening. That'll be the fact that you live in Canada then.
Yes.
And so therefore...
But you know, there's a simple solution to that.
Move to the UK.
Or just give the country back to us.
Well, the Queen's still in charge.
Well, in that case, why can't they listen to why can't they get the thing? Why can't the Queen intervene?
Okay, a good point. I'll let you take that up this week.
Thank you.
They're still in the Commonwealth. They should be able to watch our YouTube clip. But it's a copyright thing, Gareth, and that's why. For everyone else who's in the UK, you can enjoy a different Commodian rant and piece every day. Go to the Five Live website. Details from there.
It's like Blame Canada, isn't it? Shall we very quickly do two things? Let's do Dean Spanley. Dean Spanley, because you had Jeremy Northam in on the show. And a very peculiar movie, Dean Spanley is
very,
too.
Very peculiar.
Apparently based on a well-known novella, which I have to confess I hadn't read. Story is Jeremy Northam is estranged from his father, who is played by Peter O'Toole in absolute scenery chewing.
He's great.
He's fantastic. They just said, Peter, basically, you know that slightly drunken old curmudgeon character? Do that, okay? And he's trying to reconnect with his father, but his father doesn't seem to be able to feel any emotion since the loss of his son in the Boer War. In fact, the only thing his father seems to be able to relate to is a dog who he lost many years ago. Here's a clip.
Don't grovel, laddie. You remind me of Wag when he'd been naughty. What a whining and squirming he went in for.
Yes. Wag, eh?
One of the seven great dogs.
What happened to him?
He went away one day and never came back.
Have you ever done that before?
Never. I blame the bad company he fell in with. This dog that used to come around. Ugly brute, a mongrel, big scrawny thing it was. Wag chased him off at first, but he came back and Wag took off with him. Just before I had to return to school. I wanted to stay at home till Wag came back, but they wouldn't allow it. I told them, if I wasn't there, then Wag might not know where to come to.
It's been very difficult for you.
It wasn't difficult. It was unbearable.
Don't you think that it sounds as if Peter O'Toole is about to sell you some exceedingly good cakes? He's got a voice that is like biting into a great big sort of chewy currant bun, don't you think? You can hear the words sort of, you know, being...
It's fruity.
It is fruity. But it's a particularly fruity voice. Anyway, so he does that performance, which is very good. And then what happens is that the Jeremy Northam character falls into conversation with the titular Dean Spanley, played by Sam Neill. And Dean Spanley, under the influence of a particular drink, which is quite hard to come by...
It's Takai. It's quite easy. It's a pudding wine. It's quite straightforward to get. It's not difficult at all.
No, excuse me. In the film... The thing is, it is very hard to come by, and in order for the film to work, he has to go to great lengths to involve... Why are you correcting me on a matter that I'm right about?
He could go to Morrison's.
Oh, I see, fine. In the present day, he could do that, apparently. Yeah. But in the movie, the whole point about
it is... Tesco's.
Right, well, to the
It's difficult.
Fine, that's it.
In Edwardian England.
Film doesn't work anymore. Difficult. Shall we move on?
But
the point is the drink is very hard to come by, so he has to get in a guy to get the drink for him, and he starts supplying Dean Spanley with the drink, and as Dean Spanley has the drink, he starts talking as if
what
he is the reincarnation of the dog which Peter O'Toole lost.
Indeed.
Now, it sounds completely nuts, and I have to say, funnily enough, as the lights went down at the beginning of it, somebody, one of the other critics, it was there, said, I hear this is very strange. And very strange it is indeed. However... At a time in which family entertainment tends very often to play things, you know, as broad and light as possible, it was genuinely unexpected and unusual. Peter O'Toole's very good. Jeremy Northam is pretty solid in it. But the real stand-up performance is Sam Neill. And at the centre of the film is Sam Neill talking as if he was a dog in a former life. And there are about three or four sequences in which Sam Neill drinks this Tokai that apparently is completely easy to get hold of.
Very easy.
Winos on street corners are drinking it even as we speak, but in the thing that is very hard to get hold of. And for those segments alone, the film is worth seeing because there's something about the way in which Sam Neill does this beautiful storytelling by Sam Neill. Now, I'm not saying the film is for everybody, but it's a use certificate movie. There are certain things in it that might upset much younger viewers. But I was very surprised that such a strange and such an unusual story and something that would be so easy to smirk, it actually turned out to be a pretty solid piece of entertainment that was genuinely unusual and, as I said, was really held together by, at the centre of it, this lovely performance by Sam Neill reminiscing as if he was a dog without realising that that's what he was doing. And his performance, I love Sam Neill. I think he's always worth watching. And whereas Peter O'Toole is doing very broad and Jeremy Northam is doing very, very brittle and uptight, Sam Neill, I mean, I'd love
to... Do you know why he left New Zealand?
Sam Neill, he said because, well, one of the reasons he said in that, he made a documentary about New Zealand that was called something like Cinema.
More Exciting Than the Piano, I think it was called that.
More Exciting Than the Piano, yes.
He saw on one of his forms, one of his acting forms, someone had written, probably suitable only for playing homosexuals.
Is that right?
And so he left because he thought he'd get more of a chance.
He made a documentary about New Zealand cinema in which he said New Zealand cinema is only about two things. It's either about somebody staying where they are and going mad or somebody getting on a road to avoid staying where they are and going mad.
You better mention something else because we've only got a minute.
Okay,
you're
very
about
quickly,
to say Movie of the Week.
No, I'm not, because Movie of the Week is Inkheart.
Excellent.
Which we have covered in some length. We had Ian Softly in the final. Okay. I just want to say, Man from London, which is the Bellatar movie, which I saw in Cannes, I think it was 2 years ago now. It's apparently based on a thriller by George Simenon, and it's a black and white movie. And to say that it is slow moving is rather like saying that glaciers are, you know, in a fast movement pattern. And many critics absolutely loved it. And when it's described, this is how the film is officially described, about a man who comes face to face with issues of morality, sin, punishment, the line between innocence and the complicity in a crime, and this state of skepsis leads him to the ontological question of the meaning and the worth of existence. It was the most struggle I have ever had to stay awake,
and the
most struggle I've ever had to stay awake. I think it's a work of art, but I'm not sure if I dreamt it or not.
Well, I've got no idea what you're talking about.
Movie
of the Week is Inkheart.
Inkheart.
Next week, it's our final Christmas offering. If you can't do without us during the week, don't forget the Advent calendar is available.
Unless you're in Canada.
In which case,
give the
move
country
to
back.
The UK.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.